So this is partly work with my PhD student David Chan and partly joint work with David Chan. So the start of the thing that starts this off is spiral waves in excitable media. So most people are familiar with the kind of pictures you get. So you have a spiral wave in a planar excitable media, and you have situations where the spiral is kind of just moving about, and you can plot the position of the spiral tip. And if you do that, then these are the kinds of pictures that come up. So you've got the spiral moving around, you take a nice marker on the spiral, and you plot the position of that marker, the spiral tip, as time evolves. So the simplest situation is that the spiral just goes round, and the tip just makes a perfect circle in the plane. And so the spiral is an example of a relative equilibrium. It's a rotating wave. If the evolution in time is just the same as rigid rotation of space, if you rigidly rotated with the physical domain, with the experiment, then the spiral wave would just stay still. So it would just be in equilibrium. And then there's a Hopf bifurcation to this kind of quasi-periodic meandering state. So the Hopf bifurcation introduces a new frequency. So you have the spiral wave rotating frequency, and you also have the Hopf frequency, and you get this quasi-periodic meandering, as Winfrey coined the name meandering. And there are situations where you get quite pronounced petals on these kind of flower patterns, inward petals and outward petals, and even a situation where you get a linear drift, where the spiral wave just kind of moves across the plane, still kind of rotating, but moving along as well, until it kind of hits the boundary or whatever. So one of the interesting things is that these states are all observed fairly close to onset. So you can go from this to that without varying the parameter very much. So this is the kind of diagram that appears in work of Winfrey, who talks about flower gardens, and also Barclay has this picture, where there's a two-parameter space, so don't worry too much about what the parameters are. One parameter will be excitability, one parameter will be something else. And in that two-parameter space, you get this curve of Hopf points. And the idea is that underneath the Hopf curve, you just have the rigidly rotating spiral. So this is supposed to be a circle here. That's the spiral going around, and the spiral tip going around in a perfect circle. And then as you vary the excitability, you cross this Hopf curve at some point. And if you go from there to there, then the picture hasn't changed very much. This is just that supposed to be that quasi-periodic meandering. And you see this picture go to that fairly continuously. And if you go across here, then you go more quickly to this pronounced petal situation, but it's still a continuous transition. And then over here, there's this codimension 2 point, and the claim is that along this resonance curve, the picture looks like that linear drift. So there's actually something quite interesting going on. As you vary the parameter through this codimension 2 point, you go from a situation where the spiral tip is just going around in a fairly small circle to a situation where immediately the spiral tip is doing something on a large scale. And there's no contradiction with respect to basic results about differential equations, because before the transition, you're doing that, and after the transition, you're also doing that, but missing slightly, and then carrying on like this. And so on. So for any finite time, this picture kind of converges to that picture as you go backwards through the bifurcation point. But if you look at the infinite time behavior, then this picture is immediately completely different from that picture. So there's definitely something interesting going on. And at some level, this is well understood. And at some level, there's always been something I haven't quite understood. And that's kind of what I want to talk about during this talk. So, one of the nice things about this, or one of the misleadingly nice things about this example, is you can actually do some calculations. And this is what Mike Barclay did in 1994. He came up with this kind of ad hoc model for what's going on in this transition. So, It's based on symmetry and on the fact that you have this hot bifurcation. So he said, okay, well, if it was just hot bifurcation without symmetry, you'd have a centre manifold reduction to a two-dimensional space. And then he says, okay, well, there's also continuous symmetry, so there's rotations, which are called SO2 and denote by theta, and translations, which are denoted by P. I've identified the translations in R2 with a complex plane, because that makes the calculations easier. So this is the Euclidean symmetries that are inherent in the problem. And so he said that all the kind of critical behavior here is governed by the Hopf variables and the group orbit variables. And then based on symmetry, he said that the structure of the equations on this five-dimensional space have to look like this. They have this kind of skew product structure, where first of all you have the Hopf equations, x dot equals f of x. I put the basic equilibrium at the origin, and here's the imaginary eigenvalues that signify the Hopf bifurcations. That omega b is the Hopf frequency. Then you've got the SO2, the rotation equation, theta dot equals g of x. And the nice thing is that there's no theta on the right-hand side here. So in principle, if you know what x is, you can plug it into here and then integrate to discover what theta is. And I've set g of 0 to be omega r, so that omega r is supposed to be the speed of the underlying rotating wave that's undergoing the Hopf bifurcation. And then the translation equation is also nice. It looks like p dot equals e to the I theta h of x. So again, p is not on the right-hand side of this equation. So once you know what x is and what theta is, you can plug them in and find out what p is. And there's a very simple exact solution to this. Because I've assumed that f of 0 is 0, I can put x equals 0 in this equation. Once I put x equals 0 in this equation, I have theta dot equals omega r. So theta is omega r times t. And then when I put x equals 0 in this equation, it vanishes, so the translation goes away. So this is the underlying state that we're having the Hopf bifurcation from, and this is just a relative equilibrium solution rotating with speed omega r. And now the idea is you can sort of look at what happens when you have the Hopf bifurcation next to the f of x equation, plug everything in, and solve along the lines I just mentioned. So this was ad hoc because it wasn't completely clear how you reduce rigorously to these skew product equations, but there's been subsequent rigorous results by various people, and starting off with Claudia Wolf in 96, and it's now seems to be pretty well understood. So I can show you how the calculation goes, just to get an idea of what's going on from a computational aspect. Let's see what happens if we actually try to solve these equations. So I have to put the bifurcation parameter in. So lambda is the bifurcation parameter. So the first equation is x dot equals x lambda. I don't have to solve this because I know the Hopf theorem. The Hopf theorem tells me I get a branch of solutions x lambda t, and what I know about these solutions is they're periodic, and their period is roughly given by that frequency. In fact, they're 2 pi over omega b lambda periodic, where omega b of 0 is omega b. So that's the x dot equation. Then I go to the theta dot equation. So theta dot is now theta dot equals g of x lambda. And so I plug this solution in, and I get g of x lambda t lambda. That's a non-autonomous equation now, but there's no theta on the right-hand side. Moreover, because this is a periodic function, this is a periodic function. The only dependence on t is over here. So this is a nice periodic function. So I can write it as a Fourier series. Sum over n that's a general Fourier series expansion of the right-hand side, which I can now integrate term by term. And there's a constant term, A0 of lambda, which when you integrate it, you get A0 of lambda times t. So we get theta of t is A0 of lambda times t. And the rest is just going to be periodic, and all that's going to happen is you're going to divide the Fourier coefficients by I omega b lambda. So I just write it as A n tilde of lambda e to the I n omega b of lambda t. And this is the sum of n not equal to zero. So remember that this is just a rotation variable, so this is not anything unboundedness going on here. This is just saying you go around the circle with this new speed, but that speed is modulated periodically by this stuff. So I'll rewrite this as omega r lambda t plus, and this stuff is just 2 pi periodic again, 2 pi over omega b lambda periodic. So I defined omega r of lambda as just being the new constant term in the theta equation, and then we've got this periodic modulation of this new speed. And it's easy to see that omega r of zero is just the old, the frequency of the old rotating wave. So that's the theta equation. And then we can plug this into the p dot equation. Again, I put the bifurcation parameter in, other than that's unchanged. But this is now, theta is over here. So we have e to the I omega r lambda t, e to the I theta tilde t lambda, and that's e to the I theta, and then h, we know what x is now, h of x lambda t lambda. So this is just a periodic function, because theta tilde was the periodic part of theta, and again this is periodic of the same period, so I can write this as a Fourier series. And we get that. And then again we have to integrate to find p. And typically there will be no constant term this time, because typically omega r of lambda plus n omega b of lambda will not be zero. So that's the non-resident case. That's kind of typical. And in that case, you can just integrate term by term again, and all that happens is that bn lambdas get divided by this quantity times I. So we get p of t is e to the I omega r lambda t sum over n. So we get this. And that's basically the quasi-periodic meandering state that we saw. This is just 2 frequency, because you've got this frequency and you've got that frequency, but this is going to be a nice bounded behaviour, so it's just that picture. But if you have a resonance, so there's some value of m, some integer, such that omega of r of lambda plus m omega b of lambda is exactly zero, then when you try to integrate, you again have a constant term. The bm lambda term is just constant, so you get a bm lambda times t. So p of t plus some So you get this behaviour, and that's this picture. it's kind of relatively periodic. There's only one frequency here because I think I missed out that term here. It should still be. It should still be that term in front. So there's two frequencies here, but there's a relationship between them. So this is actually a periodic term, but then you've got this linear drift term superimposed. So that's where this comes from. So this was Barclay's explanation as to where we got the meander, and he computed these non-resonance conditions. This one is non-resonance, and this one is resonant. And one other aside, by the way, is that this quantity here is actually like, if you do a bit more of a detailed calculation, you can verify that this coefficient in front of the T is like lambda to the M over 2. Whereas this bit here is like lambda to the half at leading order. So this periodic bit is bigger than the linear drift. If M is large, then it might take quite a long time to see this. So it'll eventually look like that, but M equals 1 is kind of the most visible case. And this transition curve, this resonance curve I've drawn vertically there, is basically the line omega r of lambda plus omega r of lambda plus omega b of lambda equals 0. So that's the curve in a two-parameter space. So that's well understood. So there's two things. There's some things I still don't really understand. One thing I'd like to say is that, well, one thing that bothers me is that the conditions for non-resonance and resonance came at the end of the calculation. You had to do the calculation and then you can see these coming up quite clearly, but there ought to be a way of seeing these conditions before you do the calculation. And secondly, the structure of the equations. This calculation relied on the fact that we could solve equation by equation. First the x dot equation, then the theta dot equation, then the p dot equation. And it's not totally clear in advance that you should have been able to do that. So, and it's quite easy to find situations where you can't do this. So, if we now did the same thing, but in a spherical geometry, so now you can think of spirals, you can think of an excitable media on a sphere, a fairly large sphere, and then you can have meandering spirals there as well. The symmetry group is now SO3, which is the group of 3x3 rotation matrices. So just 3x3, I've written out the word orthogonal, it should be 3x3 orthogonal matrices of determinant 1. I'm also going to need the Lie algebra, which is basically all the infinitesimal 3x3 rotations. So it looks like the tangents. Well, anyway, so it's just 3x3 skew symmetric matrices, it turns out to be. And then we have, along the lines of Barclay, we have the Hopf variables and we have the symmetry group, which in this case is not the group E2, but the group SO3, the three-dimensional rotations. So I call that X and this gamma is going to be the symmetry group. And again, using results of Fiedler, Sanchez, Schill, and Wolf again, and stuff like that, you can rigorously reduce the skew product equation, where you have the Hopf equation, x dot equals f of x, which is decoupled. You can solve that first, and then plug it into the group equation, which in general has the form gamma dot equals gamma psi of x. You can, we could again suppose that the f equation is as before, so the equilibrium is at the origin, and we have the Hopf frequency omega b. And we can suppose that at x equals 0, we can just call psi of 0 some Lie algebra element, some skew symmetric matrix, which I'll call eta. Then you have an exact solution, relative equilibrium, where x stays at 0 and gamma just goes along e to the eta t. So you just exponentiate this 3x3 skew symmetric matrix. So nice coordinates. You can always choose the coordinates. So the eta looks like this, particular skew symmetric matrix with a frequency of, so this is basically corresponds infinitesimally to rotating around the vertical axis with speed omega r. And if you exponentiate that for e to the eta t, you just get this 2x2 rotation matrix and a 1 over there. Again, it's rotating around the vertical axis. So this is the underlying rotating wave that we want to bifurcate from. So if you, I'm not very good at drawing spheres, but at least things on spheres, but on a sphere, there's the equator, there's the North Pole, whatever. Here, we've just got some spirals here, and it's just going around on the surface of the sphere in a perfect circle around some axis that's sticking out here. Okay, so that's the picture. And then you can ask again, what happens as you vary the parameter and get the Hopf bifurcation coming in? And various people worked on this, and it turns out that if you push all the machinery through, you get the same calculations as before. So again, you get meander. So what will happen is that this will now just kind of be a more thickened quasi-periodic version of this circle, and you get a resonance when at exactly the same place as before, where the rotating wave frequency is an integer multiple of the Hopf frequency. And what happens there is that this circle now goes around the sphere and comes around the other side and then joins up again. So there's no non-compactness, so it can't be a linear drift, but infinitesimally it's like a linear drift, but it's just a rotation basically around a completely different axis. So this was rotating originally around here, and now the centre of rotation is somewhere down there, and you're kind of going around the sphere and around the other side. So you get the same answers, which may or may not be surprising. So the first person to do this was Claudia Wolf, and then from different perspectives, Adela Comaneci and David Chan also worked on these things. But the calculation is much harder, because there's a real fundamental difficulty here, which is that when you try to solve this equation on the group, where this is now elements of SO3, and these psi's are in the Lie algebra, so they're 3x3 skew symmetric matrices, then you can't easily solve these equations. There's something, a fluke with the Euclidean group is that it's a solvable group, and that means you can solve the equations by repeated integrations. But SO3 is the opposite. It's what's called a semi-simple group. And this thing's basically semi-simple means not solvable. So what you'd like to do is you'd like to just say, okay, well, gamma t is the exponential, the integral of this thing in the right over here. So you can do that if it's a scalar equation. More generally, you can do it if these psi's all commute with each other. So if it were just two-dimensional rotations, all the psi's would commute with each other, and this is a perfectly valid formula. But in SO3, the rotations don't commute. In the Euclidean group, rotations around different origins don't commute, but you can separate out the rotations from the translations, and solve the rotations first, and then the translations. So that's the difference. See, we can't do this. The only kind of general results about this is that you can use Floquet theory. Floquet theory says that because this is a periodic forcing term on the right-hand side, when you try to solve this equation, it's going to look like a rotating wave, e to the eta t, for some eta, times some, where eta is the Lie algebra element, times a periodic correction. So it's a periodically modulated version of a rotating wave. But that doesn't tell you anything about the resonance phenomena. And in particular, it doesn't tell you, it doesn't distinguish this picture from just the localized picture. So you've still got to do something to get something out of it. Floquet theory just tells you the structure of the solutions, but you've still got to do some work to find it out. So there are basically two aims of the remainder of this talk. First of all, one aim is to show how to efficiently solve these equations. So this is what David Chan did, using ideas, normal form ideas from Fiedler and Turiyev. He showed how we could simplify this equation to the situation where you actually could solve it in the non-resonant and the resonant cases and see the difference. And the other thing which I'm going to talk about actually more is understanding in advance what a resonance is. So I want to be able to say when it's resonant without solving the equations. And trying to really understand what I talked about, this discontinuity of the long scale behavior, and there is a discontinuity, and I want to be able to understand that in advance. And these two things are linked. And to get a proper theory, it turns out to be better to forget about the spiral situation and just focus on the case of compact symmetry groups, because compact symmetry groups just have a nicer structure, and we can exploit that, see what's going on, and then try to go back to the non-compact case. Okay, so Let's see how far I can get.
So when you say understand the resonant condition,
yeah,
the resonant condition is just that there's a one of the your hot bifurcation frequency is a multiple of your original.
Not clearly for general group, and in fact it's not true for general group. So, it just happens to be true
it's
for.
It's not what you think of as the obvious resonance condition. The two frequencies are related.
It is a relation between the frequencies, but it's definitely not. To start, there could be several frequencies because the relative equilibrium could be quasi periodic. For high dimension, for groups like SO4, you'd have a two frequency motion. And so then what's the relationship? And yeah, there's something else going on. So you'll see later on what is special. Why SO3 works the way it does, and what the general statement is. So, yeah, so hopefully that will become clear. So, the general setup is that we've got gamma is a compact connected lead group. So, compact because that's going to make the theory work nicely to start with. Connected because All of the stuff I'm talking about is only seeing the connected part of the group, so we just throw away the rest. And so you can think of gamma as being, if you like, you can think of gamma as being a subgroup of SOS. Any compact connected Lie group can be realized as a subgroup of n by n orthogonal matrices with determinant 1, but not necessarily all of them. And I'm also going to need the Lie algebra, which I denote by L gamma, and this is just all the infinitesimal versions of the symmetries. So what that means is you look at this object. What you do is you take a family in gamma. So one parameter family is not the right word. Let's say curve. Curve is better. Just take a curve of symmetry elements that you can differentiate. And suppose that it goes through the identity at time 0, and now just differentiate this curve and set time equals 0, and that's the Lie algebra. So it's the tangent space of the identity of the group.
I guess, are there even an infinite number of resonance conditions?
Not for a compact
group.
For a compact group, there's infinitely many, because there's infinitely many values of there.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we get the skew product. So this is all kind of understood. So you can get the skew product, x dot equals f of x lambda, and gamma dot is gamma psi of x lambda. So again, f is going from R2 to R, so the bifurcation parameter, but f is going from R2 cross R to R2, so that's the hop. And psi is going from R2 plus R to the Lie group of gamma. So the equations are on R2 cross, I should say, it's on R2 cross gamma, and the right-hand side is a vector field, so it goes into the tangent space, which is R2 cross the Lie algebra of gamma. And because it's hop, we again are going to suppose f of 0, in fact, we put lambda, it's going to be identically 0, and df at 0, 0 is 0 minus omega b, omega b 0. So the f equation is exactly as before, and the psi equation, I'm going to suppose that psi is 0, psi of 0, 0 is eta. So the underlying relative equilibrium we can again solve. So I'll call it x zero of t gamma zero of t to indicate the fact that it's at lambda equals zero. So the subscript is lambda. And this is just 0 e to the eta t. So again, you can just plug that into the equations, and the way I define things at 0 means that this is a solution to that equation. And one thing I want to stress here is that the... is that somehow, first of all, the important thing here is eta, in that the long-term behavior of this relative equilibrium is governed by the Lie algebra element eta. So modulo the symmetry just for the origin, and if it's going to do anything interesting, it's because of eta here. The other thing I want to just point out is that the data for this problem is eta and omega b. So when I wanted to talk about resonance, it should be a condition that just involves what the relative equilibrium is doing before the bifurcation and what the hot frequency is. So the eta kind of captures the omega r's that we talked about before. So whatever the condition is, it should be something that we state just in terms of those. And then we have the relative periodic solutions. Which I'm going to call x lambda of t, gamma lambda of t. I'm going to suppose that the Hopf bifurcation is supercritical. So this is for lambda greater than zero. X lambda of t is just the 2 pi over omega b of lambda periodic solution. And what you do again is you, in principle, you can't do the calculation this time, but in principle, you just take your Hopf solution to the x dot equation, plug it into the right hand side of the gamma dot equation. So this is supposed to be the solution to gamma dot equals gamma psi x lambda t lambda. So I'll take the initial value problem, so I'll make gamma of lambda 0 just to be the identity element, just the identity matrix. So this is now the well-defined relative periodic solution, and it's relatively periodic in the sense that every period this comes back to where it started, but this will have moved along the group orbit. So, let's see, at time t equals 0, we have x lambda of 0 identity. So I plug t equals 0 into the solution, this is just obviously x lambda of 0, and by my normalization, my initial value has to be the identity, so the group element's just the identity. And then at time t equals 2 pi over the b of lambda, this is, x has come back to where it started, and gamma lambda t has come to some other thing, which I call sigma lambda. And then it just repeats periodically. So at time t equals 4 pi omega b of lambda, by symmetry, you can see that if you started from here, you would just multiply the I by sigma of lambda, so you get sigma lambda squared. And then you just go on and on like that. So you get the iterates of sigma lambda on top of the periodic behavior over here. So what we see from this is that this is the thing that governs the long-term behavior of the relative periodic solution. And now what we'd like to do is relate sigma of lambda. What's the relationship between sigma of lambda and eta? Well, what we know is that for any time t, gamma lambda of t converges to gamma 0 of t as lambda goes to zero. All we've done is we've changed the right-hand side of the gamma dot equation slightly and taken the solution, that the initial valued identity. So for finite times, this solution will behave the same as that solution, and as lambda goes to zero, this will converge to that. So we put the period in, we get gamma of lambda 2 pi omega b of lambda goes to gamma of zero, and obviously this period, this quantity here is going to omega b of zero. So we know the gamma lambda at the period of the relative periodic solution goes to gamma zero at this kind of hot period. This is what I called sigma lambda, and this I call sigma zero, so I'll give that a name. But sigma zero you can compute from over here. It's just e to the 2 pi over omega b times eta. So I've introduced a new quantity. But this quantity is in terms of the initial data. It's just the eta and the omega b. So if you take this to the algebra element that comes from the relative equilibrium, multiply it by the Hopf period, and exponentiate, and this defines a group element. And what I know is that sigma lambda, which is the thing that governs the long scale behavior of the relative periodic solution, is going to be close to this group element. So now I've reduced it to a group theoretic question. I'm saying that if the behavior of this group element doesn't change very much under perturbation, then the Hopf behavior is going to be very similar to the relative equilibrium behavior. Whereas if this is a group element that can change a lot, then you can get a completely different behavior for the relative periodic solution. So to take things a bit further, we back to the relative equilibrium, we've got this eta. What happens as time increases, e to the eta t just takes all possible values as t lies in R. So let me define quantity t0 to be all the things of the form e to the eta t where t is in R. And then I take the closure. So this is kind of telling us about what's happening long scale on the relative equilibrium. It's just basically the relative equilibrium basically is this quantity. But this quantity is a subgroup of gamma, and it's a nice subgroup because it's compact because I've taken the closure, and it's connected, and because we basically connect everything by T in the real line, and it's abelian, even though gamma wasn't abelian, because powers of e to the eta are all going to commute with each other. And then you're taking the closure, so that's still abelian. And this is the definition of a torus. A torus is just a compact connected abelian group, which just means it's a product of circles. So a circle is a one-dimensional torus, then any general torus is just products of that. And it's a basic result that generically generically, it's what's called a maximal torus. So a maximal torus, the notation is kind of fairly clear. You take a torus inside the Lie group, and then you ask, are there any bigger, any higher dimensional tori that contain it? And if not, it's called a maximal torus. And then there's some nice results about maximal tori for compact connected Lie groups gamma. So the first result is that first of all, if you've got two maximal tori, they have the same dimension. And in fact, there's a much stronger result. They're basically the same. They're just conjugate. You can find a group element. So actually, if you conjugate one torus by the group element, it gives you the other maximal torus. So there's basically one maximal torus up to conjugacy. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that for any gamma contained in gamma, there exists a maximal torus T such that gamma is contained in T. So any element is contained in a maximal torus. And then the third thing is that for most gamma contained in gamma, there exists a unique maximum torus. So this is kind of the algebraic background I need from compact Lie groups. First of all, that there's only one, and secondly, that every element is contained in one, and thirdly, that most elements are contained in precisely one. And I want to make precise what most means here, so probably better keep that. So, make a definition. There's another thing first. I'll say that gamma contained in gamma is regular if it's contained in precisely one maximal torus. So I'll just write it like that. Gamma is regular if it's a unique maximal torus T that contains it. And I claim that most elements are regular. So I define U is a set of regular gammas. And then it's well known that this is open and dense in gamma. So it's an open dense subset. It's got full measure. So the natural measure on a compact empty Lie group is the Hahn measure, and almost every point with respect to that measure is regular. And it's actually extremely big, because if you look at the codimension of the complement, it's greater than or equal to 3. So the claim is that maybe I should say things are singular otherwise. So it's singular if it lies in more than one maximal torus. And if you take the set of singular elements, that's closed, and it's actually a union of submanifolds, and you can prove those submanifolds have got very low dimension compared with the group. They're at least 3 dimensions smaller than the group was. So if you take the group SO3, just as an aside, the SO3 is a three-dimensional group. So the singular elements are just a finite set of singular elements. In fact, there's just one, we'll see in a moment, but it's telling you that there has to be a zero-dimensional set. Right, so there's another result which I won't write down, but that basically if you've got a regular element, you can associate with it. Maybe I'll write it down here. You can do gamma goes on to T gamma for gamma mu. So given any regular element, you have a unique maximal torus, which I call T gamma. So this is a subset of the compact group. And the claim is that this map is continuous. So if you look at the maximal torus, if you change gamma slightly, the maximal torus only changes slightly as a subset. So if one maximal torus looks like this, the next maximal torus just looks very close. So that's T gamma. This is T gamma prime.
If you parameterize T gamma by its conjugacy to some fixed one, and then that conjugacy varies smoothly?
That would certainly be one way of doing it. And that'd probably be a sophisticated way of doing it. I was just thinking that I put the Hausdorff distance on the set of subsets of the compact group, and then this will be a continuous map in that between those two metric spaces. So anyway, this now actually gives the answer away. Once you start looking at this idea of a regular element, what we said here is that if you look at the group corresponding to gamma, it will only change slightly if the element is regular. So this is a group element which generates the long-term behavior of the relative equilibrium, this generates the long-term behavior of the relative periodic solution. If this is regular, which it almost always is, then this will be regular, and its maximal torus will be very similar to this one. So we now have the correct definition of what a resonance and non-resonance is. And we'll see in a moment it's quite powerful for actually doing computations. That's the eraser. There's an eraser somewhere, I think. There's another one down here anyway. Right. So I've got that. So this is now coming back to the bifurcation where I've got the relative equilibrium with an eta and the hop frequency omega b. And we say that's non-resonant if e to the 2 pi over omega b eta is a regular element of gamma. So that's the thing I called sigma 0. And it's non-resonant if it's singular. So it's resonant if singular. And in some sense, this is the correct definition. So I can kind of formulate the following result. I could look at E, which is basically take the relative equilibrium and the so this is the full-time trace of the underlying relative equilibrium. That's a subset, which I call E. I can also define P lambda to be the corresponding trace of the relative periodic solution, and maybe make these closed. So these are the dynamic effects. Now the theorem is that in the non-resonant case, the distance from P lambda to E goes to zero as lambda goes to zero. So the distance is defined as, sorry, not sure I have time. I ought to define what the distance is. So if I've got A and B are subsets, then first of all I could let X B in A, and I'll define the distance from X to B the infimum over B, contained in B. So I've got some underlying distance on the set that I'm interested in, and I look at these subsets, and I take a point in the first set, and I look at the closest point in the second set. So that measures the distance of the point X from the set. And then I can define the distance of A to B to equal the supremum over all A's in A, of all X's, distance from X to B. So if I want to know the distance of a set from a second set, I just look at the worst case of all the distances of each individual point from the first set to the second set. So that's the distance of the set A to the set B. And that's not quite a metric, so I can also define DAB to be the distance of AB plus the distance BA. So two sets are equal if A is close to B. Two sets are close if A is close to B and B is close to A as sets. So that's the sense in which I mean that the distance of the relative periodic solution converges to the relative equilibrium as lambda goes to zero. The other way round doesn't quite work because there's a rational versus irrational thing where sometimes this set gets much smaller as you vary a parameter lambda. But what you can say is that on a set of, so for almost all lambda, I'll just say this somewhat sloppily, for almost all lambda, D distance, the total distance of p lambda e goes to zero. What I mean by this is ignore a countable set, ignore a set of measure zero of values lambda, and just take the limit as lambda goes to zero, excluding values of lambda in that set of measure zero. And then you find that both distances go to zero. So actually the whole set is basically the same as this set as lambda goes to zero. So that's in a non-resonant case. And in the resonant case, In the resonant case, both distances do not go to zero as lambda goes to zero. P lambda will just go to some completely different maximal torus from the one that E would see. And that's what we saw in the spherical symmetry case, where this is E, it just sees this kind of motion, whereas the P lambda sees that kind of motion. So this set does not converge to that set as the bifurcation parameter goes to zero. So that's the resonant case. So and I should also say, even if you do this trick, deleting sets of measure zero, these two limits do not go to zero. So it kind of shows that the definition of resonance and non-resonance I've given is an intrinsic dynamical definition. It's not a do the calculation and see what happens. Actually, in advance, you kind of know when it's going to be resonant, when it's going to not be resonant. So, some examples. So I'm going to do SO3 and SO4 to kind of give the general idea of the claim is, even though this is a bit abstract, it's actually very easy to compute the resonance conditions from this definition. So let's take the group gamic with SO3. If gamma is in gamma, then I can write gamma as cosine theta minus sine theta . So first of all, I want to work out what's a regular element and what isn't a regular element. So if I want to work out if it's regular, I can put it in nice coordinates. So I can write it as this rotation on the vertical axis, which I prefer to write this as e to the I theta 0, 0, 1. You have to be careful, we're using complex notation here, but obviously if it's block diagonalized like this, then it's clear what this means. Suppose A is contained in gamma, and A gamma equals gamma A. And also, let's suppose that theta is non-zero. So let's take the case theta non-zero. So this is not the identity matrix. If a matrix commutes with it, then the basic fact about commuting matrices is they have to preserve each other eigenspaces. So this has eigenvalues plus or minus e to the I theta, which are different from 1, because theta is not equal to 0. So A must look like e to the I psi 0, 0, 1. So every single matrix that commutes with this matrix, and this is a pretty general matrix, has this form. But these all commute with each other, and these form these define a torus. It must be the maximal torus that contains gamma, because it's the only thing that's abelian that contains gamma. So this is the maximal torus that contains gamma. So this is a typical element. This is the largest kind of torus we can get. So we see immediately that the dimension of T is 1. Maximal tori are one-dimensional for the group SO3. And also, we see that every element is regular except for the identity element, which obviously lies in lots of maximal tori, because there's no reason why they should have to rotate around the vertical axis anymore. So U in this example is all the gamma contained in SO3, but gamma is not equal to the identity. So we saw there had to be a zero-dimensional set by the codimension condition, but actually it's everything that's not the identity. So that's the first part of the calculation. The second thing is to look at sigma zero, which is e to the 2 pi of omega v eta. Because the condition for resonance is, does this, is this a regular element or not? We want to know when it's not regular. Well, we also can choose coordinates. So it's omega r. We can now kind of normalize, independently of the previous calculation, which was just a computation of regularity, we now go to the differential equation, normalized to the eta, looks like this. And typically, omega r is not equal to zero, so this defines the circle. And maybe I'll write this again as I omega r 0, 0, 0. Complex notation just looks like this. And then I can exponentiate this quite easily. E to the 2 pi over omega b eta equals e to the 2 pi I omega r over omega b 0, 0, 1. Okay, just get the rotation matrix corresponding to this, but it gets multiplied by 2 pi over omega b. What definition for resonance? This is resonant if this is equal to the identity matrix, because resonance is singular, i.e. not in U. So it has to be the only singular element, which is the identity element, and therefore you see immediately that omega r is m omega b. So you see the calculation, the result for resonance that we knew drops out of this criteria. So now a case which maybe people don't know, the group SO4. To do the same calculation, if gamma is contained in SO4, then it's easy to show that gamma can be written as e to the I theta 1, 0, 0, e to the I theta 2. And I'm going to suppose that theta 1 is not equal to theta 2, and also not equal to plus or minus theta 2. And I claim that's the condition to be regular. So it's nothing to do with zero eigenvalues anymore. I'm quite prepared for this to be the identity, provided that's not. But I want that this number is not plus or minus that number, obviously working mod 2 pi. So the claim is that this is, if and only if, regular. And the calculation, I should just sketch how it goes. The point is that if these are not equal, then the eigenvalues of this matrix are different from the eigenvalues of that matrix. So the commuting matrix these look like e to the I psi 1, e to the I psi 2. So there's a two-dimensional torus that contains these elements. This is the typical element, so certainly lots of these have to be regular, so the maximal torus is two-dimensional. Therefore, all of these are regular, and you can do a calculation and show that if this condition is violated, then actually you get extra maximal torus that contain it. So that's the first thing, and then eta is going to look like I omega 1 0 0 I omega 2. It's going to be a quasi-periodic, a two-frequency relative equilibrium, two omega r's, omega 1 and omega 2 now, and we look at e to the 2 pi r, 2 pi of omega b eta, and you get e to the 2 pi I omega 1 omega b 0 0 e to the 2 pi I omega 2 omega b. And we have to ask, is that regular or not? Because that determines whether it's a resonant or non-resonant bifurcation. And so we see that the condition for non-regularity is that this is plus or minus that. So we need 2 pi omega 1 over omega b equals 2 pi omega 2 over omega b plus or minus mod 2 pi, which then you see that this is saying omega b is m times omega 1 plus or minus omega 2. So that's the condition for a resonant bifurcation if you had the group SO4, that the hop frequency is an integer multiple of the sum or difference sum or difference of the frequencies of the relative equilibrium. And again, you can do this. We know from the theorem that this is the correct condition, and we've computed it. And what's going to happen? I mean, it's kind of hard to visualize what's going to happen on SO4. I can't draw any pictures. But before the bifurcation, you've got this two-dimensional quasi-periodic motion. And what happens as you get to this singular case is that you still pick up, you're going to get a new two-dimensional maximal torus, and one direction is going to be in common with the old one. It's kind of fairly easy to see, but I don't want to get into the details here. But you've got two directions worth coming from the maximal torus, and at the bifurcation, you keep one of them, but then you get a new direction that's completely different from the old second direction. It's kind of this picture that you go from being in here to being in there with a common axis, but obviously a curved version of this picture. Okay, I'm out of time, so I just say that actually this condition was computed by Friedman and Turayev. They also came up with the definition of this as resonance, but their definition was a computational one. They came up with a normal form theory for solving the skew product equations, and they said you've got a resonance if some monomial that you ought to be able to remove can't be removed. And so this condition is the same as this, as theirs. This is a dynamical definition, whereas theirs is a computational definition. But it means that when you actually try to do the Friedman-Turayev normal form theory, this condition comes up naturally in the normal form calculations. And obviously I haven't got time to show how that goes, but it turns out that knowing this theory in advance helps to, plus using the Friedman-Turayev theory, comes up with a very easy way of doing your calculations of what's going on in a resonant bifurcation. In particular, the quantity lambda to the m over 2 that we saw coming up in the particular calculation for the Euclidean group turns out always to come up in the resonant case as well. There's always an m here, and whatever the condition is, and that also comes up in the kind of scaling of. So basically it says in this particular example of SO4, you kind of go quickly along one of the old directions, but you also kind of you quickly go along this direction, but also you slowly go along this new direction, and you don't see that other direction here anymore. Okay, so I better stop there. Okay, so thanks.